My name is Nigel Relay. I am an associate member of the McGill School of Environment and a professor in the Department of Geography. And it's my pleasure, I've been asked to introduce Professor Naomi Oreskes. Professor Oreskes is an internationally recognized scholar for her work in the history and philosophy of science, and in particular for those that have followed her writing. She has written a lot on what I would call generally the environmental earth sciences. In 1995, I was introduced actually to a paper of hers that was published in Science. I was at a meeting, actually I believe it was with a group of people with the IPCC, and we were talking about models and how everybody was validating their models, and somebody pulled out this paper that was called Verification, Validation, and Confirmation of Numerical Models in the Earth Sciences. And it was very great food for thought for us around the table. I think it's also been food for thought for an awful lot of people that are working in environmental earth sciences. I checked today. The paper has, he controls that, I don't. So if you have volume problems, put your hands up and he will, they have volume problems at the back. They can't hear. That's right. That's right. We may be a great university, but we have a hard time with microphones. How's that? Can you hear now? Yes? All right. Okay. So as I was saying, we are at this meeting, and we had this paper that we looked at that was a 1995 paper on models, verification, and validation. And I looked today on Scopus and checked, and over 800 people have cited this paper. And what's really remarkable is that it's still being cited at a very high rate right now. For example, there are 12 citations already in publications in 2011, and it was cited over 80 times last year. So it has staying power, this paper. Naomi has written many books, book chapters, and scholarly articles on science, how we think about science, how we look at rules of confirmation, the history of ideas and how they have come about, how some have been accepted. She's also written about how it's taken a long time for certain ideas to be accepted, like continental drift, for example, plate tectonics, and things like this. But what is really remarkable, if you look at her output, is that she has been almost equally productive in attempting to communicate to the public important issues in science, and particularly recently around issues of uncertainty, the climate issue, debates around how we know, how we use models and various different things like this. And this has come through many radio broadcasts, op-ed pieces in newspapers, and some of the prominent newspapers in the United States. And all you need to do is type her name into YouTube, and you'll see that she's a media star. So she is a professor in the history of Department of History and the Program of Science Studies at University of California at San Diego. She is the provost of what looks like a very neat place on the webpage, Six College. Its aspiration for this college, and I quote, is UC San Diego's newest college, born as a new century was beginning. Six College aims to prepare its students to become effective citizens for the 21st century, innovative, interconnected, and aware. It's also very nice to see a provost that signs their name Naomi on the university webpage. So she has received many honors, too many to mention here, but I just want to mention a few because it'll give you a flavor of it. I think someone that is a historian of science, having the honor of being called receiving the Francis Bacon Award of History and Philosophy of Science and Technology must be kind of the piece de resistance to get that. The USCD Chancellor's Associate Faculty Excellent Award for Community Service, Scripps Institution for Oceanography's Teacher of the Year, and she is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS. Recently, her research has highlighted the disconnect between the state of the scientific debate and the ways in which it is presented in the mass media and perceived by the American public, or I think the public in general. As most of you are probably aware, she teamed up with Eric Conway to write her most recent book, The Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming. And that is the subject of her talk tonight. So please join me in welcoming our speaker, Professor Sorekas.
Well, Professor Roulet, thank you so much for that generous invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here, kind of a privilege to be reminded what cold weather feels like. And also, as I was telling some people, I was here briefly a few months ago for the History of Science Society, but before that, the last time I was in Montreal was in 1967 for the Expo, which I remember very clearly. It was kind of a highlight of my childhood growing up when my family rented a car and we drove from Manhattan to Montreal. So, and the other thing I wanted to say is that was a very generous introduction, and it made me think about how much I really appreciate the opportunities that I've had as a historian of science, history of science being rather a boutique field that often provosts and chancellors and rectors don't even know what it is. And it's really been kind of a privilege for me to be able to be a historian of science, to have the privilege of studying science as a human activity, and to be able to use that study in ways that I hope have been useful to other communities. So this is a pitch for History of Science and to support your local historian. So with that, let's get started. In 2005, my Austrian governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, announced an initiative to commit the state of California with its 33 million people to Kyoto Treaty level cuts in CO2 emissions. And when he made this announcement, he said, "I say the debate is over. We know the science, we see the threat, and we know the time for action is now." Well, it's not every day you get to agree with a politician, especially an Austrian one. So I was really struck by the fact that my Austrian governor seemed to understand the scientific dimensions of climate change. But he was also nearly alone among Republican political leaders in the United States at that time, or even today. Much more typical were the views of people like Vice President Dick Cheney in 2007, who did an interview with American media after the release of the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And Vice President Cheney said, "Well, I think there's an emerging consensus that we do have global warming. Where there does not appear to be a consensus is the extent to which that's part of a natural cycle versus the extent to which it's caused by man, greenhouse gases, etc." Sarah Palin, similarly in 2008, election told voters, quote, she wasn't sure that climate change wasn't simply part of a natural warming cycle. And indeed, the positions of these leaders seems to have been influential in American people thinking, because around that same time, only 41% of the American people thought that global warming could be explained mostly or entirely, or most 41% thought that it could be mostly or entirely explained by natural variability having nothing to do with human activities. Indeed, in 2007, a major opinion poll showed that 40% of the American people thought there was no scientific consensus and that there was a lot of disagreement in the scientific community over whether global warming was happening or not. So even just the fact of it happening, much less the human causes, nearly half of American people thought scientists were still arguing that point in 2007. Now, I would argue, Eric Conway and I have argued, that these views were not a coincidence, because in fact, emphasizing scientific uncertainty and alleging a lack of consensus had in fact been made the official policy of the U.S. Republican Party. In 2007, Frank Luntz, a leading Republican strategist, advised candidates for political office to use the phrase climate change rather than global warming, because he said, climate change is a lot less frightening than global warming. He advised candidates to emphasize scientific uncertainty and to insist that there was no consensus in the scientific community. "The scientific debate remains open," he wrote. "Voters believe that there is no consensus about global warming within the scientific community. Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, their views about global warming will change accordingly. Therefore, you need to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue in the debate. So we see the idea of scientific certainty and scientific consensus and dissent being used as a political strategy, explicitly, overtly, consciously. Well, was Luntz right? Was the scientific debate still open? The answer to that question is no. In 2001, so 2 years before the Luntz memo and 6 years before Vice President Cheney's comments, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in the third assessment report had declared unequivocally that scientists did have a consensus that global warming was happening and that it was caused mostly by human activities. So they had written, human activities are modifying the concentration of atmospheric constituents that absorb or scatter radiant energy. Most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. So they were pretty clear about it. Now, admittedly, you had to go to page 21 to find that, but it was, in fact, there. In fact, the science had actually coalesced earlier. As early as 1995, in the second assessment report of the IPCC, scientists had concluded, quote, that the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human impact on global climate. So the human causes, the human impact, was there all along in the IPCC report. And of course, this really should not have been a surprise to anyone, because it was this emerging scientific consensus which had led, in 1992, to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was based on the early warnings of the IPCC and many other scientific groups in the late 1980s and very early 1990s. Many North Americans have forgotten that the United States is a signatory to the UN Framework Convention, which pledges its signatories to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And when he signed it, President George H.W. Bush called on world leaders to translate the written document into, quote, concrete action to protect the planet. So what happened? Why didn't the United States and the world take those concrete steps? And why did the Republican leadership after George H.W. Bush turn against climate science and begin to insist that there was no consensus and that we didn't really know whether climate change was happening or whether it was caused by human activities? So what I'd like to do here today, then, is to give you a very, very brief history of the evolution of climate science, just a few key points, to recount, then, the emergence of a political challenge to that science, a challenge that was ideologically motivated, rooted in the ideology of free market fundamentalism or laissez-faire economics, and based on the idea of selling uncertainty, as in that Luntz memo, to argue that action would be premature at best and, at worst, entirely unnecessary. Well, historical stories always have to start somewhere, and in this story, a good place to start is with the work of the Irish experimentalist John Tyndall, who first established in the 1850s that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas. Indeed, he established the concept of a greenhouse gas. Namely, he discovered that certain gases, like water vapor and CO2, have a highly distinctive property of being very transparent to visible light, but rather opaque to infrared radiation. So light comes in, but heat tends to be trapped. And Tyndall recognized that this was an important feature of the Earth's atmosphere, because without these greenhouse gases, the Earth would be as cold as the Moon or Mars and completely inhospitable to life. So this is over 160 years ago that this basic scientific framework is laid down. Now, the first person to suggest that if you change the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, it could change the climate, was this man, the geochemist Svante Arrhenius. Arrhenius was the first to point out that when you burn fossil fuels like coal, you release carbon dioxide as a byproduct, and that carbon dioxide could accumulate in the atmosphere and alter the planet's climate. He did the first calculations of what the effect of doubling CO2 on the atmosphere would be and concluded that it would be between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. Now, Arrhenius was Swedish, so he thought global warming would be a good thing. The first person to suggest that it might be a bad thing, that it might be disruptive, was the British steam engineer Guy Stewart Callender, who in the 1930s published an article in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Meteorological Society suggesting that carbon dioxide might actually already be increasing from burning coal and that the temperature might be increasing too. Well, that was in 1938. 1939, war broke out. Callender became involved in war work, and the issue was not really picked up again until the 1950s by a number of different scientists, including Gilbert Plass, Bert Bolin, and a number of others, but perhaps in hindsight most famously by these two men, Hans Suess and Roger Revelle, professors at the University of California. In 1957, they wrote an article in the peer-reviewed oceanographic journal TELUS, in which they argued that mankind was performing a great geophysical experiment by returning to the atmosphere in a very short period of time, less than a century, the carbon dioxide that had been stored in rocks over the course of hundreds of millions of years of geological history. And they began to argue for the importance of paying attention to this transformation, monitoring it, and to see whether or not changes in the climate were resulting. The person who began that monitoring work was this man, also a professor at the University of California, Charles David Keeling. In 1958, as part of the International Geophysical Year, Keeling began the systematic measurement of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which has come to be known as the Keeling Curve, for which he won the National Medal of Science awarded to him by U.S. President George W. Bush. Today, the Keeling Curve is one of the most widely reproduced time series data in the history of science, but already by the early 1960s, Dave Keeling was beginning to talk about what he had found. And what he was able to show was that there was a very systematic seasonal variation in carbon dioxide associated with photosynthesis, since most of the land masses of the world are in the northern hemisphere. There's a very consistent increase in carbon dioxide in the northern hemisphere winter and a decrease in the summer when plants take up carbon dioxide. But in addition to that strong seasonal signal, the sawtooth up and down, there was also the evidence of a trend that his measurements were showing that there was already, by 1965, a detectable increase in the total atmospheric CO2. And this led him and Roger Revelle to co-author part of a report in 1965 to the U.S. President's Science Advisory Committee, in which they predicted or forecast that, quote, by the year 2000, there will be about 25% more CO2 in our atmosphere than at present, and this will modify the heat balance of the atmosphere to such an extent that marked changes in climate could occur. So as early as 1965, we see scientists recognizing that carbon dioxide is indeed increasing, as Arrhenius and Callender had suggested it might, and that that increase could change the chemistry of the atmosphere in ways that could impact the climate in a serious way. Marked changes could occur. That message actually reached the White House under President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who in a special message to Congress said, quote, this generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. So if anyone ever says, well, no one knew or no one could have anticipated this, here it is. Not only did they know, but the President of the United States knew it too. Now, the development of the science at this point is fairly complicated. There are fairly large and interesting arguments in the 1960s about the role of different atmospheric pollutants, including some that could cause global cooling. But with the rise of computer modeling, there soon emerged a strong consensus among climate scientists who are actually doing work on the question that given the rise of CO2 that Keeling had documented, that sooner or later global warming would occur. This consensus was expressed in many places, including reports from the World Meteorological Association, the Royal Society, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, and many other groups, but perhaps most explicitly in a press release in 1979 when the U.S. National Academy of Sciences summarized the scientific work that they had reviewed for a report for the Carter White House. And they wrote, quote, a plethora of studies from diverse sources indicates a consensus that climate changes will result from man's combustion of fossil fuels and changes in land use. One of the undergraduates today started our discussion by asking about the question of consensus in science, about whether that's a goal of science, whether it should be a goal of science, whether it's a good thing, whether it's a bad thing. When I found this document, it was one of those things where you wake up in the archive, because I thought, well, here it is in 1979. It's the scientists themselves using that word and saying, yes, we have a consensus that these climate changes are expected. We've also seen some of the critics of the IPCC have argued that the IPCC has focused too much on greenhouse gases and not enough on land use changes. So I thought it was interesting to note that already in 1979, scientists understood that we weren't only talking about greenhouse gases, we were also talking about deforestation and urbanization and other land use changes that can also impact the climate. But the big question was when. So I've argued that if we talk about the consensus about climate change, we have to be somewhat specific about exactly what we mean by the consensus. And I would say that the consensus on climate change has emerged in stages. So the first stage, we could say, was this. It's effectively a consensus about a forecast, about a prediction, about something that is expected on physical principles to occur. But there's no claim here that this is actually happening yet, nor is there any kind of specific claim about when this would happen. It simply said that it will result. So what did that mean to say that it will result? Well, at the time, most scientists thought will result meant by the year 2000 or perhaps even later. In fact, one scientist that I interviewed who was involved in this 1979 study said he went to a briefing at the Carter White House in which one official asked him, well, when is all of this going to happen? And one scientist said, well, maybe in about 40 years. And the staffer said, come back to me in 39. Now, a few mavericks, however, suggested that climate change might already be underway. One of these was John Perry, who was the chief staff officer for the National Academy of Sciences Climate Research Board. And in an article published in a peer-reviewed journal in 1981, Perry wrote, physically, a doubling of CO2 is no magic threshold. If we have good reason to believe that a 100% increase in carbon dioxide will produce significant impacts on climate, then we must have equally good reason to suspect that even the small increase we have already produced may have suddenly altered our climate. Thus, he concluded, climate change is not a matter for the next century. We are most probably doing it right now. Well, was John Perry right? Were changes already underway? Roger Revelle addressed that question in 1982 in an article in Scientific American in which he wrote, mathematical models of the world's climate indicate that the answer is probably yes, but an unambiguous climate signal has not yet been detected. So that unambiguous signal really became the holy grail of many scientists, including the IPCC, to say not just that climate changes would occur, but to be able to answer the question, are they actually already occurring? And the answer to that came sooner than most scientists expected. It came only 6 years later, when NASA climate modeler James Hansen and his team concluded that the signal had, in fact, been detected. In testimony to the U.S. Congress, as well as in peer-reviewed scientific literature, he explained the scientific evidence and declared that he was 99% certain that climate change had, in fact, become detectable. So it was this emerging and disturbing evidence that climate change was perhaps happening faster than had been anticipated that led in part to the creation of the IPCC and also in the United States Congress to the introduction of legislation to address it. So in 1988, a group of U.S. senators introduced the U.S. National Energy Policy Act, quote, to establish a national energy policy to reduce the generation of carbon dioxide and trace gases as quickly as is feasible in order to slow the pace and degree of atmospheric warming. And the New York Times in August 1988 reported, the issue of an overheating world has suddenly moved to the forefront of public concern. So we see a fairly clear articulation of the science, we see the recognition of the problem by politicians, and we see the media also recognizing that something is happening, some kind of coalescence of interest and concern and public attention. But at the same time as this scientific understanding was coalescing, that Hansen was saying that climate change, that the signal had been detected, so too was a campaign to cast doubt upon that science. This campaign focused on the claim that the science was unsettled and therefore it was premature to act. And as a historian, I'm always interested in origins. So in our book, Eric Conway and I trace the origins of this claim, and it turns out that the origins can be traced to a rather small handful of people and a think tank. Now, today, as many of you know, there are attacks on climate science and climate scientists from many different quarters. This issue, this pattern has spread very far and wide. But one of the most important of the sources of these attacks for a long period of time, going back to the late 1980s, is the George C. Marshall Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. For many years, this think tank denied the reality of global warming or insisted that if there were warming, it was not caused by human activities but could be explained by natural climate variability. As recently as 2007, the Institute quoted Timothy Ball, a Canadian climatologist, who argued that the widely propagated fact that humans are contributing to global warming is, quote, the greatest deception in the history of science. When I first read this, I thought, what, don't Canadians teach people about the Piltdown Man? So where did the Marshall Institute come from? And why have they promoted doubt about climate science? Well, the Marshall Institute was founded by three men. Shown on the left, Robert Jastrow, an astrophysicist and the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. On the right, William Nirenberg, a nuclear physicist and longtime director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And in the center, Frederick Seitz, a solid-state physicist, president of the National Academy of Sciences in the 1960s and president of the Rockefeller University in the 1970s. So all three physicists, all three highly prominent, successful physicists, and all three who had built their careers during the Cold War in American nuclear weapons and rocketry programs. These men had known each other for many years. They had served together on many committees. And in the early 1980s, they found themselves working together on an advisory panel to the Reagan administration on the Strategic Defense Initiative, what most of us knew of as Star Wars. In 1984, they founded the Marshall Institute to defend SDI against a scientist boycott. Most scientists thought that SDI was not feasible, but that even if it were, it was a bad idea because it would be destabilizing. SDI was a departure from the long-established Cold War doctrine of mutual assured destruction, and therefore would be destabilizing because if the United States thought that it had an effective defensive missile shield, it might be tempted to launch a first strike, a preemptive first strike against the Soviet Union. So the whole balance of terror, which had been used to preserve the peace in the Cold War, would be undermined. For this reason, 6,500 American scientists and engineers signed a petition declaring a boycott of program funds. And this was historically unprecedented in the history of the Cold War. And it greatly upset the Reagan administration, and it greatly upset Jastrow, Seitz, and Nirenberg, who, against the vast majority of their scientific and technical colleagues, argued that SDI was feasible and, moreover, necessary and, indeed, urgent. Between 1984 and 1989, Jastrow, Seitz, and Nirenberg worked to defend SDI by promoting an alarming view of Soviet strength and a frightening picture of American weakness. I don't have time to go into all the details of the arguments they became involved with. It's in Chapter 2 of the book if you're interested, but I just want to give you my favorite example of a kind of typical thing that they wrote at this time. This article, America Has 5 Years Left. Climate skeptics always like to point out that, you know, we don't really know if climate models are true. We don't know if the predictions will come true. Well, here's one prediction that did not come true, for better or worse. Now, at the time, Frederick Seitz had retired from the Rockefeller University, and he had taken one last job, working as a consultant to the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Corporation. Now, as we know from the historical work of scholars like Alan Brandt and Robert Proctor, David Michaels, and others, the principal strategy of the tobacco industry to defend its product against the scientific evidence of the harmful health effects was doubt-mongering, to insist that the science was unsettled, that we didn't really know, nobody had proven whether smoking really caused cancer, that we didn't know what the mechanisms of cancer were, and therefore it would be premature for governments to intervene to control tobacco use. In 1989, these two strands merged. The Cold War ended. The Berlin Wall came down. The Soviet Union began to break apart. And our three old Cold Warriors might have rested content. As one of my students said to me, why didn't they just go play golf? These men helped to win the Cold War. But instead of resting content, instead of being satisfied that their life work had achieved the goal that they hoped it would, instead they found a new enemy. And that enemy was what they called environmental extremism. And they applied the tobacco strategy, which Seitz had learned working with the tobacco industry, to insist that the science was unsettled, that we didn't really know, and therefore it would be premature for governments to act to control the threat, if there even was one. Doubt is our product, ran the infamous memo written by one tobacco industry executive in 1969, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. But one of the key insights the tobacco industry realized early on was that doubt mongering only worked if scientists would supply it. These scientists supplied it. And not just on the harms of tobacco, but also on the threat of nuclear winter, the reality of acid rain, both in Europe and here in the United States, the severity of the ozone hole, the human causes of global warming, and more recently, in a kind of revisionist history, attacking the scientific evidence regarding the harms of the pesticide DDT. The scientists in our story denied the severity of all of these problems. And in every single case, in case after case after case, over the course of 3 decades, they insisted that the science was too uncertain to justify government action. And no one, until we wrote this book, seemed to have noticed this pattern. Now, to find out how they did it, you'll have to read the book, which is on sale for $32 in the back. What I want to spend the rest of my time talking about tonight is why they did it, because I actually think this is the most interesting part of the story. When we first started working on this, Eric Conway and I would look at each other and say, why would these guys undermine the work of their own colleagues? These are scientists. These people understand scientific methods. They understand climate models. Why would they claim that all of this work published in peer-reviewed journals is no good? And most people, when I first started working on this, most people thought this would be a simple story of scientists being corrupted for money. But all of the available evidence shows that it's not about the money, but rather it's about ideology, and specifically the ideology of free market fundamentalism. Free market fundamentalism is the term that George Soros has developed to describe what we can think of as a kind of end member of a spectrum of belief that falls under the category of modern neoliberalism, a set of beliefs focused on deregulation, of empowering the individual, and releasing the so-called magic of the marketplace. It came to prominence in the early 1980s under Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom and Ronald Reagan in the United States, continued through the 1990s, led by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair through the so-called Washington Consensus to foster growth through market deregulation, and indeed through the Harper government here in Canada as well. Its intellectual roots can be found in the ideology of two key thinkers, who, if you haven't read, I strongly advise reading because it really helps you put into perspective what the argument exactly here is. And these two thinkers are Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. In 1962, Friedman wrote a book entitled Capitalism and Freedom, whose title really sums up the argument. And this was a book that was highly influential in conservative ideological and political circles in the United States. Friedman argued that capitalism and freedom are two sides of the same coin, because civic freedom and free markets are inextricably linked, because if governments seek to control markets, the only way they can do that is to control the people who are the actors in those markets. And once the government begins to control where you work or what you can buy, then it's only a matter of time before they control other aspects of your life as well, and we're on the slippery slope to tyranny. In the introduction to Capitalism and Freedom, Friedman acknowledges his debt to Friedrich Hayek, the Austrian economist who's considered to be one of the founders of neoliberal thinking, who was a passionate opponent not just of Soviet-style communism, but also of Western European social democracy, which he feared would put us on the road to serfdom. Now, the contrarians in our story took the argument even one step further, and that was that environmentalism was a slippery slope to socialism, because environmentalists generally argued for government regulation, whether it was regulation of the air pollution that caused acid rain, or the regulation of cigarette smoking on airplanes. And from regulation of acid rain or secondhand smoke, it was only a small step towards government control more broadly. This idea was articulated in several of their writings and can be found in many, many writings of right-wing thinkers in the United States and elsewhere, but most clearly by a fourth scientist who joined the cause, this man, S. Fred Singer. Singer's biography is remarkably similar to the other three merchants of doubt in our story. Again, a Cold War physicist. In fact, he was the proverbial rocket scientist. He began his work working in rocketry programs, became the first director of the U.S. weather satellite service, and like the others, was involved in campaigns to challenge the evidence of acid rain, global warming, the ozone hole, and the harms of tobacco. Now, I mentioned that Seitz had worked for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company for 6 years, from 1979 to 1985, and in the early 1990s, Singer joined forces with tobacco as well, working with the Philip Morris Company to attack the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to defend secondhand smoke. Now, this is an interesting twist in the story. It's one of the few places where the tobacco industry made a serious tactical error. The tobacco industry decided they didn't like the term secondhand smoke because they figured Americans didn't like secondhand things. So they decided they would come up with a title that they thought sounded more innocuous, which was environmental tobacco smoke, or ETS. But this turned out to be a huge error because it invited the scrutiny of the Environmental Protection Agency. And in the early 1990s, the Environmental Protection Agency started to investigate the question of whether or not secondhand smoke was harmful to bystanders. In 1993, Singer and Jeffries wrote a report attacking the EPA, a report published by yet another think tank, the Alexis de Tocqueville Institute, but with the money being sent from the tobacco industry to the think tank, which is another pattern that we talk a lot about in the book, and we can talk about more in the Q&A. The report was called EPA and the Science of Environmental Tobacco Smoke. Now, the EPA had declared secondhand smoke to be a Class A or proven carcinogen, and this result was affirmed by the U.S. Surgeon General. An independent expert panel concluded that secondhand smoke was responsible for 3,000 additional adult cancer deaths per year in the United States alone, not counting other places, and between 150,000 and 300,000 additional cases of bronchitis and pneumonia in infants and young children. And perhaps most worrisome of all, that it was implicated in an increase in sudden infant death syndrome, or COT death. The evidence was supported by diverse independent studies, but Fred Singer and Kent Jeffries attacked it, claiming that it was junk science and that the EPA had rigged the results to get these claims. So if this evidence was supported by diverse, independent, peer-reviewed science studies by oncologists, epidemiologists, and public health officials, studies in the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, and Europe, why would a rocket scientist challenge it? Indeed, why would anyone defend a product that was shown to be killing babies in their cribs? Well, Fred Singer answered that question in his own words. He wrote, "If we do not carefully delineate the government's role in regulating dangers, there's essentially no limit to how much government can ultimately control our lives." Indeed, throughout the conservative and libertarian writings of this period, we find the suspicion, even the overt allegation, that environmentalists are socialists in disguise. They refer to environmentalists as watermelons, green on the outside and red on the inside. The U.S. columnist who writes for the Washington Post, George Will, has referred to environmentalism as a green tree with red roots. And Senator James Inhofe, who has threatened to indict climate scientists for conspiracy to lie to Congress, has accused these scientists of being part of the liberal conspiracy to bring down global capitalism, to which I reply that scientists should be so organized. But the point, I think, is clear. This debate was not about the science. Indeed, none of these debates, from secondhand smoke to acid rain to ozone depletion to global warming, none of these debates have been about the science. They have always been about governance, about the proper role of governance, and where the government legitimately has an interest in protecting us from dangers and where that legitimate interest ends. And that's a legitimate question. It also explains the origins of this story in the Cold War, in a group of men who fought the Cold War, but who in doing so took on a Manichaean vision in which communism came to stand for all that was wrong and free market capitalism came to stand for all that was right. Or as I put it, added this because I just gave this talk in Norway where they still remember the occupation, it was free markets über alles. Now here's the thing. We can have a legitimate debate about governance and the proper role of the government in protecting us from dangers. And some environmentalists may be socialists. In fact, I gave this talk in Melbourne, Australia, a couple of months ago, and at the end of the talk, a man in the front row stood up quite
firmly, put his shoulders back, and said, I just want to say unequivocally on the record that I am a watermelon.
So fair enough. Some environmentalists may be watermelons. But it doesn't mean the science is wrong. It doesn't mean that DDT, acid rain, the ozone hole, and secondhand smokes, and of course global warming, weren't real problems needing real solutions. Problems that don't go away just by denying them. But it does mean, sorry, no, it does not mean, sorry, and it also does not mean that the free market can solve all our problems. Indeed, history shows us that it cannot. History shows us that the world is filled with what the economists call negative externalities, costs that accrue to people who did not reap the benefits of those activities. Climate change, like acid rain and the ozone hole and the harms of secondhand smoke, are all market failures. The Stern Review of the Economics of Climate Change by Lord Stern, formerly chief economist at the World Bank, so not exactly a watermelon, has called climate change, quote, the greatest and widest-ranging market failure ever seen. And this is the common thread uniting the diverse science challenged by the merchants of doubt, the answer that explains how these seemingly completely different issues, like secondhand smoke and acid rain, could possibly be united in a single story. And the answer is that they were all market failures. They were all places in which environmentalists were indeed calling for the government to protect us from dangers that the free market had not solved on its own. Now, of course, there's a deep irony in this story, because the longer we wait, hoping against hope, hoping against all the available evidence that the free market will somehow remedy its own failure, the more we increase the likelihood that we will indeed need intrusive government action to prevent catastrophe and protect us from danger. So by fostering delay, the merchants of doubt have actually made it more likely that the very thing they most dreaded will actually occur. So what should we do? Where do we go from here? Well, 2 years ago, actually almost three now, in 2008, two colleagues of mine, V. Ramanathan and Inez Fenn, both professors at the University of California, published a very interesting article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in which they pointed out that, as many scientists agree, no matter what we do, we are now committed to global warming. The amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is such that even if we were to stop all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow and stop all deforestation, which of course we won't, we would still be committed to global warming of probably at least 2 degrees. My teenage daughter says, Mom, why do they use the word committed? Only guys think that commitment is a bad thing. So she says we should say we're sentenced. So we are almost certainly sentenced to mean global temperature increases of at least 2 degrees. And if we don't stop all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, and I think it's safe to say that we won't, and if carbon dioxide continues to increase as through business as usual, we may be seriously looking at changes of more than 2 degrees, 3, 4, 6, perhaps more. And Ramanathan and Feng has pointed out some major dislocations to the Earth's natural system that may accompany changes of that magnitude. So we've already seen, as most Canadians know, massive decreases in summer Arctic ice. We have indeed, despite a few errors in the IPCC report, begun to see significant melting of the Himalayan-Tibetan glaciers that feed most of the major river systems of South Asia that supply water to hundreds of millions of people. And as we go above 2 degrees, we can expect a strong possibility of dislocations to the Greenland ice sheet, which could lead to major sea level rise, possible serious dieback of the Amazon rainforest, and then more speculative but truly frightening possibilities involving the disruption of ocean circulation and the potential destabilization of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which it's estimated would lead to sea level rise of as much as 6 to 7 meters, meaning trillions of dollars of infrastructure and hundreds of millions of people dislocated. So how do we respond to this, given where we are today in history? Given what we know about the science, but what we also know about the resistance of people and governments to take action on this issue? Well, many have recently have begun to use this as an argument to say that mitigation has failed, that we've tried and failed to stop the increase in greenhouse gases, and that therefore we should now focus our attention on adaptation. I think that response is only half of the answer. This graph shows us that adaptation will be necessary. We will be seeing changes in our environment associated with 2 degrees of mean global temperature increase. But it also tells us that if we don't do something soon, we are looking at the potential for very grave consequences. And that tells us that while adaptation will be necessary, mitigation is now urgent. So to conclude, don't flinch now. Thank you very much. Okay, so I'm told we have time for questions. About what time should we go to on questions? Okay, so you'll give me, about 15 minutes.
There's a microphone in the center of the room, so we ask you to go to the microphone, and we'd like to limit you to one question. So we can go to the microphone, and we'll limit you to one question each, please.
Hi.
Hi.
Is it on? Yeah? Okay. My name is Mark, and thank you for that presentation, Professor Ruskus. That was very interesting. Just two, I guess, related questions.
You only allowed one, he said.
Okay.
But if you make it like an A and B, maybe you can get away with it.
I should say first off that people probably saw that there was an article in the National Post today that was like along the same lines questioning global warming. They actually did accept the science. He seemed to accept the science, but said that there's so much uncertainty as to what is actually going to happen that we shouldn't actually spend any money to do anything about it. So that I thought I would just make that point. But my question is about, are you saying that the merchants of doubt knew that the science was correct but still published papers suggesting or insisting that it wasn't? And if so, you're saying that that is in fact, you're I think implying that that's in fact what they did, knowingly or knowing that the science was in fact correct, they would say the opposite, that it wasn't. And you're saying that was motivated by ideology. Why not just take the position such as Bjorn Lomborg and say, well, yeah, we accept the science, but we shouldn't actually be spending money to do anything about it because we have other priorities and so on and so forth. Right. It's not good economic decision-making to do anything, even though global warming is happening.
Yeah. Well, okay, thanks. That's a great question. So a couple of things. First of all, I want to be really clear. These people almost never publish scientific papers, okay? The whole strategy is to create this kind of parallel universe. So they would issue press releases, they'd go on television, they would write white papers and policy statements, but they never actually did any real peer-reviewed or very, very little, very scant peer-reviewed published scientific papers. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there are different strategies that skeptics can take. And indeed, when you look at the larger universe of climate skepticism and denial, we see all these different strategies. We see there is no warming. We see there's warming, but it's not caused by man. There's warming. It's not caused by man. It is caused by man, but it would be too expensive to do anything about it. We should just adapt. Climate change is good anyway. CO2 will make more plants grow. So you see this whole panoply of different denialist arguments, and often by the same people. So if you look at Patrick Michaels from the Cato Institute, for example, he's used all of these strategies at different times. Why did these guys use the particular strategy they did? I think two things. I think partly because of the argument made in the Luntz memo, that if people thought the science was unsettled, then they would think it was too soon to have policy action. And so that is a very convenient strategy to take, because you don't have to say that the science is wrong. You just have to say we're not sure. And that's an extremely plausible argument, especially for something as complex as the climate system. But even for acid rain, which maybe there are people here in the audience remember what happened there, but I mean the Canadian government was convinced that acid rain was real. And the U.S. government, and we have a whole chapter in the book about this, it was the U.S. government and Bill Nirenberg specifically who said, well, you know, we're not convinced. There's still some things we don't understand. It's not really clear. You know, some lakes are acidic naturally, and the trees could be dying for other reasons. So this is a very clever strategy, because you don't actually have to lie. You don't have to say something that is knowingly untrue. You just have to doubt monger, and that's why we call it the merchants of doubt. And then it gets into a kind of subtle psychological territory, because if your political ideology suggests to you that environments have a environmentalists are overreacting, and maybe deliberately so because they would like to see more government regulation, then it's, I think, pretty easy to convince yourself that maybe they are exaggerating the threat. So you focus on the aspects of the science that aren't really settled, and of course there are always some. And then meanwhile, of course, this is the strategy that the tobacco industry had used extremely effectively. So Seitz has worked with the tobacco industry. He's kind of seen how this works. And so then he applies it to these other things as well.
Greg, I'm going to take the girl behind you. You two kind of snuck in front of her more aggressively. So,
wow. I love Canada. Well, all the more reason that you have to let her go first.
You have the floor.
Hi, I just had a quick question. I hope this doesn't turn into an ad hominem argument, but I was wondering why these top legislative officials, if they've seen all the scientific evidence, I can only think of Al Gore off the top of my head, but why don't they lead the behavioral change? For example, Al Gore having his like planes and his big Hummers and
Well, Al Gore doesn't have Hummers. That was Schwarzenegger, actually, but he did get rid of them. But, yeah, okay. Go ahead. Okay.
So I was wondering, someone who's such a strong proponent who's seen all the startling evidence, why doesn't he lead the first step towards changing behaviors?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a really good question, and I think it's fair enough. I mean, you could ask that about a lot of people and a lot of things. I mean, there were anti-smoking advocates who smoked cigarettes, right? I mean, we're all complicated, and people make choices about how they – you know, where they think they can make the most important contribution. And I'm not going to defend Al Gore, and I'm upset that he divorced Tipper. but you know, it is important to realize that a lot of these claims that are made are not true. So like you just said about him and his Hummers. So actually, Al Gore never had a Hummer. And often the opponents of these people will spread misinformation about them and claim that Al Gore has Hummers, and then that gets on the Internet, and all these people say this. Well, so actually, you know, Al Gore has done a lot of things in recent years to decrease his own carbon footprint. Should he probably do more? Yes. I mean, I have a lot of friends that I talk to. We talk about the paradox that the heaviest part of our carbon footprint is traveling around the world talking about global warming, right? And so I do buy carbon offsets, and I know a lot of people have, you know, mixed views about whether that's a good idea or not. There are things in my own life that I could do better, and I'm working on them. So, you know, we all have to do what we can in our own way. I agree it's good to model good behavior. I think different people contribute in a different way. And, you know, Schwarzenegger made a big fuss when he got rid of his Hummers, but he didn't crush them. He sold them. So, you know, someone is still driving those Hummers, and you got to figure that if it was Arnold's Hummers, they probably fetched a lot of money. So maybe he gave that money to a good cause. I hope he did. He may well have. I mean, he's an interesting, complicated guy, right? So thank you for the question.
A very brief question, and that is whether you noticed any discernible improvement after Obama was elected in 2008, or if he...
No, the opposite. I mean, it seemed like things were actually getting better after Hurricane Katrina. The press coverage in the United States definitely shifted after Hurricane Katrina. But after Obama came into office, it's definitely gone back the other ways. And I think we're seeing a hardening of the opposition in the United States, a kind of reaction. And that's consistent with a pattern that we've seen, that every time there's been an advance in the science, there's actually been a hardening and an increased stridency in the opposition. So I think this speaks to, this is something some of us talked about this morning, it speaks to what's at stake here. I mean, there are a lot of things at stake here, politically, economically, ideologically, and I think that as the science gets stronger and stronger, the denial gets deeper and deeper. Because it's getting harder now to look people in the eye with a straight face and say that we don't know this is happening, right? I mean, the evidence is everywhere, and especially in the Arctic. I mean, the sea ice data is really pretty staggering. And most of this data was collected not by Greenpeace, but by the U.S. Navy that's been measuring sea ice thickness since the 1950s. So it's becoming increasingly hard to deny that with a straight face. So then I think that contributes to these more spurious challenges that we see all over the place now. You know, and even these challenges like Pat Michels, who I just referred to, who's now one of the most prominent climate deniers in the United States, who's affiliated with the Cato Institute, he started talking about Obamunism. You know, so there it was again, this sort of red-baiting thing. And the whole thing about Obama really being Kenyan and not being born in the United States, the whole birther movement, I mean, what was that if not some kind of relic Cold War anxiety about infiltration by foreigners. You know, it really was kind of an amazing thing to watch. So,
next question.
A quick question about the behavior of scientists being driven by ideology. I assume that if you think that's correct for the right side of the spectrum, then you would have a difficult time arguing that would be incorrect for the left side of the spectrum. So in a way, you might be providing support for the statement that climate science is driven by ideology, by left-wing ideology.
Right.
That's kind of troubling because you're actually
undermining
the point of
The
science.
No, it's a totally legitimate question. The undergraduates and I talked about this today. So I think you have to acknowledge that scientists are human beings. And like any human being, scientists come to any problem with a whole set of background beliefs, commitments, ethics, values, the whole nine yards. And that, you know, Claude Bernard years ago famously said that when the scientist goes into the laboratory, he has to shed all of his emotions and commitments like as if it was just a coat, you know, walking in the lab door. Well, I think all of us would say today that's not realistic, right? That human beings don't have the capacity to shed their values just because they walk into a scientific laboratory or sit behind a computer screen to run a climate model. So what do you do about that? Well, one of the answers to that question has to do with the social dimension of scientific communities, that part of the reason why scientists have procedures like peer review is to address that question. You submit your paper to a scientific journal, and it gets sent out to three or more peer reviewers, and those peer reviewers have the benefit of anonymity in most cases, so they can say whatever they want without fear of retribution. And you may have come to the issue with certain ethics, values, or preconceptions, but those peer reviewers may have a totally different point of view. So the whole point of the peer review process is to expose your data, your claims, your theories to scrutiny by other people who have a different point of view. One of the things that to me was most conspicuous about the folks that we studied is the way they studiously avoid the peer review process. They studiously avoid all of the standard mechanisms that have been put in place in the scientific community to guard against this problem. Now, is peer review perfect? Of course not. Do these community mechanisms always work? No. But they're mechanisms that are set up to address these issues, and they do have a long track record. I mean, peer review goes back to the Royal Society in the 1670s, and the Académie de Française, and Accademia dei Lincei in Italy, right? These are very long-established social practices, and there's a reason why they've survived, because, no, they're not perfect, but they do seem to work pretty well. And so that's the answer to this question. Yes, all people come with their own ideological baggage, but there are mechanisms for addressing it. And if you see people avoiding those mechanisms, going around them, then that should be a red flag. And that, to me, is a really interesting thing. I was just at this meeting in Norway where we were talking about the whole stolen email affair. And, you know, many of the people who have been commenting on the stolen emails have been saying, see, this proves these people are not open enough. They need to make their data public. They need to, you know, reveal their own personal and private emails so we can all see what's going on. But when those same people making those claims, including Stephen McIntyre here in Canada, have been asked to make their data public or their personal email or even to say who's funding them, then suddenly, you know, it gets really, really quiet, right? So I think openness and transparency is really important, but it needs to be a level playing field.
I was reading recently about a study made by scientists from Yale in which they coined the term protective cognition.
Protective cognition?
Yeah, in which very individualistic people will have a tendency to not accept facts. So do you think that played a role in that with those three rocket scientists?
Well, I think we all have a tendency to accept more easily the facts that are consistent with our own worldviews and to be more resistant to facts that don't. So then the question is, what does it take to persuade us of a different point of view? And I think, you know, before I worked on this, I wrote two books related to the history of continental drift and plate tectonics. And I always like to point to an episode in the history of plate tectonics that to me is kind of one of those really wonderful moments in the history of science where you feel like, okay, science isn't perfect, but, you know, here's a moment where someone really got it right. So this is the story of Xavier Le Pichon, a French geophysicist, who did his PhD at Columbia University in the 1960s. And Columbia was famously known as a kind of hotbed of rejection of any of the idea of moving continents in any way, shape, or form. And the director, Maurice Ewing, was known to really ridicule the idea. So Le Pichon wrote his PhD thesis on heat flow in the North Atlantic. And the conclusion of his thesis was that the heat flow data showed that the theory of plate tectonics was impossible. It's definitely wrong. 6 weeks after he finished his PhD dissertation, he went to the American Geophysical Union, where he heard Jason Morgan and Dan McKenzie present a theoretical model for how plate tectonics could work. Le Pichon told me this story in an interview, and I encouraged him to write it down, which he did. He said, "I went home that night, and I said to my wife, pour me a stiff drink. Everything in my PhD thesis is wrong." So, you know, it's that capacity to be open-minded about data, to acknowledge that what you previously thought was wrong, and to change it. And the beauty of this story is that Le Pichon then went to work the next day, and at Lamont, which is at the lab at Columbia, although no one there accepted plate tectonics, they were sitting on a huge treasure trove of relevant data. So he went back and he started reinterpreting some of this data in light of plate tectonics, and he wrote an article which became, at that time, the most widely cited article in all of the history of earth science up until that time. So, you know, that's a beautiful story about open-mindedness, the capacity to change in the light of data, and to recover and then be really successful. So I think that's what, you know, to me that's, like, great science in action, you know.
I assume this is after he had his PhD defense.
Yeah, this is all totally, like, and he even said to me when we were talking, he goes, "And if you dig up my PhD and quote from it, I'll never speak to you again."
Okay, we'll try to get the three questions in there in line, and that will be it. Then I think Naomi is willing to sign some books.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
okay.
I was just thinking that the merchants of doubt, it's very easy to ridicule them because they're able to form, change the opinions of many people. But in science, it's generally very important to also question. So don't they actually do? They have a place to question. Where I think they go wrong is persuading millions of Americans or millions of people worldwide that the doubt is more reliable than the evidence.
Yeah.
But I would just argue on the other side that they do need to have a voice as well.
Absolutely, and I would never argue that people don't have a right to be heard in scientific meetings. But again, two things. First of all, you know, a lot of times these people like to call themselves skeptics, and I don't accept that term because I don't think they are skeptics, because I think what you're saying is exactly right. Healthy skepticism is an essential part of science. It drives inquiry. Without skepticism and curiosity, there would be no science. But again, the question is, where's the line between healthy science and unhealthy doubt-mongering, right? Well, healthy science, you go to a scientific meeting, you present your data, you say, "Look, I think there are anomalies in the data. I think there's things you guys haven't explained properly." And, of course, that goes on at scientific meetings all the time. I mean, if you go to the American Geophysical Union, it's filled with people expressing healthy skepticism about all kinds of stuff. But that's a really different thing than going outside the scientific community, issuing press releases, publishing articles in Fortune or Forbes or the Wall Street Journal, making ad hominem attacks on scientists. I mean, if you read the book, you'll see they do all these things. Altering the results of a peer review paper, which is what they did on the acid rain question. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff they did that are, you know, breaking the rules of the scientific game. You can't tell me that that's healthy skepticism, right? You know.
Next question.
What would you say to students who are doing research and whose research is going against the ideology of the Republican Party, for example? It's like I'm very discouraged because I feel like the lobbies in the field where I'm doing my research, I feel like those lobbies are way too strong, and I have absolutely it's like not even useful. It's not going to be useful at the end because I'm not going to be heard.
No, don't give up. Remember what I said, don't flinch now, right? I mean, we need you now more than ever. Look, I mean, it is kind of a David and Goliath story, right? But on the other hand, look at the tobacco story. The tobacco industry was hugely powerful, and a lot of people didn't think that there would be effective tobacco control in the United States. But there's been massive social change on tobacco. Far fewer people smoke in North America than was the case 50 years ago. It's become socially unacceptable to smoke in public in most places. The problem of secondhand smoke has been almost entirely eliminated in North America, and it's increasingly being addressed in Europe, too. So how did that happen? I mean, I've been asked a lot about that, about, well, how were people able to succeed against the tobacco industry? It was wildly powerful. I mean, they owned senators. I mean, people used to joke about the senator from Winston-Salem, right? I mean, the senator from Philip Morris. So I think there were three things that were really crucial in tobacco case. One was science, right? There was a lot of science, and it was mostly epidemiological, and we didn't know, and we still don't entirely know the mechanisms of lung cancer, but there was a lot of science. Second thing, there was leadership. The role of the U.S. Surgeon General, I think, was extremely important in the United States when the Surgeon General was prepared to come up in public. And, you know, the first Surgeon General report in the United States, the Surgeon General knew there was going to be such a bombshell that he released it on a Saturday because he was afraid that if he released it on the Monday, it would cause a stock market crash. That was how important the tobacco industry was in the U.S. economy, right? But I think the leadership of the Surgeon General played a really big role. And I think the third thing was litigation, because the litigation exposed the truly nefarious practices of the tobacco industry, right? It exposed that this was not just an honest industry making an honest product that you as a free individual could decide for yourself as a grown-up. I mean, the tobacco industry always said, you know, we're grown-ups, we can decide for ourselves. If a grown-up wants to smoke, it's not for the government to tell him what to do. The government, you know, shouldn't be a nanny, right? Well, I don't think they use the word nanny in the United States, but you know what I mean, right? Government shouldn't be our babysitter. Well, but it turned out that the tobacco industry had known since the 1960s that nicotine was addictive. So it's one thing to say it's fine to choose for yourself whether you want to smoke or not. It's another thing to be selling an addictive drug. And when the tobacco industry was indicted under the racketeering laws in the United States, one of the key documents was a document, I think it was from 1962, where one of the tobacco industry executives says, "We are then in the end in the business of selling an addictive drug," right? So the litigation exposed all of this and really exposed that the tobacco industry arguments, you know, were a sham, right? And I think that was hugely important. It was hugely important shifting the views of the American people to realize, as I said, these weren't just honest businessmen selling an honest product, right? So in climate change, we've got the first one, right? We've got huge amounts of science going back to Revel and Susan and all those guys. But I think we haven't had enough leadership. We haven't had the Surgeon General figure, the kind of politically neutral figure that's, I mean, the problem with Al Gore is that he's too much identified with the Democratic Party, so huge numbers of people just won't listen to what he says no matter what. So we need the Surgeon General equivalent, somebody who's trusted, somebody who is in a position of leadership but isn't viewed as aligned with either political party. And I think we need litigation. I think we need to start thinking about under what laws can we begin to bring to bear the power of the courts, because that's the place, at least in the United States, where ordinary citizens have had the most success, you know, in the David versus Goliath start kinds of efforts. So I encourage everyone, particularly in the United States, where lots of undergraduates are aspiring lawyers, talk to people you know who are lawyers or law students and start thinking about what laws could be used. Because in 1961, no one would have predicted that the tobacco industry would finally be caught under the racketeering laws, right? Those were laws that were written to stop organized crime. Nobody would have predicted that Al Capone would be got on tax evasion charges, right? So one of the things we know from history is that you don't always get people, you know, for the main thing they did wrong, because it's not, you can't always prove it or the law isn't clear, but sometimes you can find things that you wouldn't have expected would work. And, you know, the RICO statutes in the United States, I mean, I don't know if any of you have read the court decisions, but it's really worth reading them because it is staggering what the courts, you know, found the tobacco industry guilty of. And you read those documents and you think, wow, you know, this is a really powerful instrument. And these judges were very courageous people, but they were in a position where they were able to exercise that courage. So think about litigation.
Okay, I will invite Maryland's Professor Marilyn Scott, the director of the McGill School of Environment, to thank you.
So I'm going to take over this mic, which I haven't been able to figure out whether it's been working through this whole session. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah? Okay. So first off, I'd like to acknowledge very much the funding that has made your visit possible. We would like to acknowledge Global Environmental and Climate Change Center for funding, the Situating Science Group, and also we received funding through the Beattie Memorial Fund to support this visit, and of course the McGill School of Environment. We chipped in a little bit as well.
And persuaded.
And persuaded persuaded you to come and to take 2 days to be in Montreal. And so we're really, really delighted to have, for us to have that opportunity, for you to take time to meet with the students and the faculty, and really to, I think, what a terrific example of someone who brings together the natural sciences, coming from a background in geology and earth sciences, and moving into history and everything in between. You can sort of, how could you get further apart on the two ends of what we see as a spectrum? And so thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you for the model that you are providing to our students as something that they can aspire to, for the inspiration of hope, I think, and for actually helping us to understand what remains in many people's minds, this, how could it be that people don't understand and don't take seriously what we actually understand to be true. So let me think what else I'm supposed to mention. There are books at the back, and we're going to have a constrained book signing opportunity, because we're going to want to pull our guests off to a reception starting at 7:30. So rather than congregating up here with questions, could I encourage you, if you would like to have your book signed, to let Naomi go to the back and get behind the desk or whatever she's going to do for signing a few books. I do have, hold on, okay, I'm going through my list. And I did, on behalf of everyone here, like to present you with this very small gift, token of our appreciation, and thank you very much for...
Thank you.